a reason why. We have not all been born perfect. There is a reason why virtue must be achieved. It is not thrust upon us. Virtue comes to the individual as a personal choice. The power that created man gave him the power to be right, because it gave him the ability to decide, to explore, to contemplate upon the phenomena of life. And it gave him the great textbooks which were necessary for his own salvation. Of these, in most nations, the greatest of these textbooks is the universe itself, which he can gradually probe and explore. The second textbook is the sacred writings that have descended to all peoples from ancient times. These are very largely summations of moral and ethical principles, the laws of living. The third textbook is man's own body, in which in miniature all the processes of nature play out. That which is bad for the body of the individual is bad for his world. Man was placed here to gradually unfold his own consciousness, to gradually open himself to ever-increasing and improving levels of consciousness, until finally he would be aware of and one with the one principle at the root of life. This was therefore a school. And it was a school in which millions and billions of little atoms, which are in the body of God, are growing up. This school has its rules, its laws, its principles. This school teaches certain necessary subjects. And the school of life is probably the most rejected but most necessary of all educational institutions. The individual is never frustrated in his ability to learn. It is his inclination to learn that is usually at fault. After we begin to think about this, we realize that the entire pattern, the entire program, has as its real substance that it shall produce the enlightened person. And it shall produce it because that individual earns that enlightenment by his own conduct, by his own insights, by his own efforts. It is not bestowed. It is revealed and released through him by his own efforts, by his own indefatigable determination to find the answer to himself. Many ancient peoples gave much thought to this, and they realized that in some way there must be a means or a method by means of which the individual could more rapidly learn the lessons of life. So several different disciplines were bestowed upon man in ancient times. The first and basic of all these disciplines was purification. This was the great discipline of the ancient Greeks, that the individual, before he can become wise, must purify his life of those corruptions which make wisdom impossible. In other words, purification was not merely washing your hands, nor was it bathing in a sacred tank. Purification was the cleansing of the life. It was the elevation of integrities. It was the proper use of emotional, mental, and physical potentials. Purification was the right to be right. It was the right to use every facility that has been given to us in the most constructive, idealistic manner. Purification was of the body, was accomplished in antiquity by dietetic restrictions, by leaving off certain foods that were not useful, to break away from all things entering the body which are likely to corrupt the body. It was ventilation, it was exercise, it was the gradual putting of the body into the most perfect condition possible, so that there were no naggings from the flesh, that the individual was not constantly beset by pressures which arise primarily in the body. This was the beginning of the life of wisdom, that the individual should build a house according to the law. And if he builds this house of his own flesh according to the law, the living God will dwell therein. Having gone through purifications, moral, ethical, physical, those seeking truth then settle themselves upon a way of wisdom. What do you have to do to learn? How are you going to improve knowledge? The Greeks followed the same system as the Hindus, the Chinese, and practically all other nations. They placed the student seeking to know under the guidance of those better informed than himself. So there were schools of teaching. There were great scholars. There were philosophers. There were mystics. And there were the state mysteries and all of these institutions which existed to communicate to the individual more and more of the divine plan. Therefore, next after purification came a type of discipline. This was no longer merely disciplining the body. It was the disciplining of the emotions and of the mind. The individual who can't control his temper is not going to be able to experience the presence of God. He may think he is, but if it comes in this form, it must be questioned as being an hallucination. The individual who cannot control his thoughts cannot become truly wise. And where the will within the person uses both the mind and the emotions for the gratification of its own personal ambitions, then we truly have Samson bound to the millstone of the Philistines. We have something great, splendid, magnificent, immortal, tied down to the smallest, insignificant, and inconsequential activities. So the mind has to be controlled so that it thinks straight. The emotions have to be controlled so that feelings are noble, gentle, kind, compassionate. To gain this mental discipline, which was so required, it was necessary also to convert or convince the mind. It had to be taught how to think. It had to be taught how to escape those opinionisms which Epictetus calls a falling sickness of the reason. It is the gradual cultivation of common sense. Mental discipline is grounded in common sense. It is the individual capable of the kind of straight thinking we find among primitive people. The same kind of thinking that does not necessarily found itself in intellectualism, but in an intelligible advancement towards wisdom. This type of thinking drew upon the wisdom of the ages and gave the person the keys to organized mental activity. The Greeks liked to think that mathematics, astronomy, and music were the master sciences by which the mind could be disciplined. Mathematics gave the concept of exactness. Astronomy gave the concept of vastness and inclusiveness. And music gave the concept of harmony or adjustment between living things. Those who were grounded in these were ready, perhaps, for higher advancement. But there was a catch in this, which we have overlooked. Namely, that these ends, these sciences, are to be acquired for the enlargement of consciousness and not the enrichment of the purse. In Greece, there were a number of professional teachers who were called sophists. And they were held in poor repute, largely because they educated for a fee. They were like tutors. And they were looked down upon as by that very circumstance alone that they'd made a fee, that in one way or another it was not a complete dedication to truth. Now, some will say, well, if you did that today, most of our educators would be in the poorhouse. That might be true, but it wasn't true then. Because the ones who became the great leaders of Greek thought for over 300 years, producing over 200 of the world's most enlightened thinkers, did not make that type of charge. They were supported, they were helped, their disciples loved them, their disciples saw that they wanted nothing and needed nothing. but their wants were few and their needs were few. And the relationship between the disciple and the teacher was practically free from all economic factors. So the career of the teacher must be primarily a dedication to instructing those who need instruction, and should not be based upon an increasing wage bracket, almost to the point where our educational institutions face strenuous reductions in overhead. Having earned a certain amount about discipline of the mind, having become fairly well versed in mathematics, and having a basic insight into astronomy as it was known to the ancients, the next thought, of course, was music. Now, music was aimed not at the mind, but at the heart. Music was harmony. Music was the joy of melody. Music was the magnificent expression of artistry through choral singing, through instrumentation, and through every device that would be harmonically acceptable. Now, music had its rules also, and the ancients were very definite in pointing out the difference between music and noise. They were also very clear in their differentiation between the attainment of harmonic enlightenment and the danger of enharmonic discord. The Greeks were fully aware that the whole story of life could be summarized in the story of music. They knew beyond all doubt that wherever music is corrupted, society suffers. Wherever discords of sound are encouraged, internal integrity is threatened. Today we live in a world of noise. Most of it is enharmonic. Much of it is strident. And because of its effect upon our own inner lives, our musical theory itself has been corrupted. So that today, enharmonic compositions, the so-called pieces of music that have no actual inspirational value, are becoming more and more frequent. These simply are means of stimulating emotional reaction without integrity. So music, corrupted, has given us many of our problems. Every area of knowledge, when corrupted, becomes dangerous. Every field of research, when abused, becomes a menace. Now we should know these things, and we should have the courage to try to do something about it. But the trouble seems to remain, as it always has remained, that skills of all kinds are not related to religion. The scientist does not feel himself indebted to religion. He does not believe that it is necessary for science to be controlled by something stronger than the human mind. The sciences are not isolated mental phenomena. The scientist who is undevout is in constant danger of corrupting knowledge as he corrupts skill. There has been much advance in scientific knowledge in recent years, but much of it has been dangerous. Wherever a science exists by itself, for itself, and of itself, it is dangerous. Wherever any branch of knowledge isolates its own peculiar content, and enters perhaps into conflict with other sciences, or at least is in a more or less non-adjusted relationship. Wherever this exists, the benefits of science are reduced and its dangers are increased. Probably the dangers of science have become greater and are now overwhelmingly menacing. We discover that a great part of science is not dominated by a determination to serve other people. It is a determination to advance a kind of knowledge, a desperate determination to prove something rather than to discover value as far as the public mind is concerned. Thus, science today has more or less forfeited its birthright. It has not stayed true to its real purpose. Bacon, in his Novum Organum Scientiorum, the new organ of science, tells us that the end of science is that man shall learn on a scientific level all that it is possible for man to know, and that all he learns shall be dedicated unselfishly to the well-being of all that lives. That's the second part that's missing. And because that secondary part is not there, we must assume that the level of idealism, even of the most educated, is not high enough to cause a dedication. It is not strong enough to lift the individual out of his own selfishness into an integrity for the common good. The same is true of government. People's worked with government for a long, long time. One Greek said on an occasion, "As fortunate is that governor for whom the people wish the best, for it is those who fear for him and not those who fear him that have achieved a leadership that is real." This type of thinking is very old, but it is basic. And there's something inside of all of us that recognizes basics when we give them proper attention. There is no doubt in the world that we are in a position to appreciate value. But too much of the time, we have neither the opportunity nor the leisure to cultivate value. This is a very serious limitation in our way of thinking. So when it's all said and done, we live in a perfectly honest universe. The trouble is that we are not too honest ourselves. We live in a world that rewards virtue and punishes vice. Therefore, we have prison after prison loaded with those who haven't learned this. We live in a world that wants us all to be happy. But we cannot all be happy while two-thirds of us haven't enough food. We are supposed to rejoice in the advancements of science. And as a result of these advancements, we sell weapons to one nation or another. We haven't learned the very basic facts of life. That either we work together, or what we call civilization will fade away. And if it fades away, it will probably be quite a time before it builds back again. We do not want to face a repetition of the Dark Ages. We want to gradually wake up to the fact that all exploitation is against a natural law, and nothing can be against law and survive. For a little time, the dishonorable person seems to flourish like the Green Bay tree, but in the course of time he is cut down, because the mills of the gods grind exceeding small. No matter what we do, it has its consequences. And the thing we want to do now is those types of things that have good consequences. And we can start right in with ourselves and try to get a greater insight. Because when we go out of here, we go into a condition or dimension of existence in which what we really are is all important. What we have, what our worldly estates have been, how successful we have been in business or politics, even though we have been the rulers of nations and have received all kinds of awards for our skills, these things are of no consequence whatever. They are part of a delusion that man has built. The thing that counts when we go to where things do count is kindness most of all. And with that, understanding, compassion, and dedication. And if we believe in the law of reincarnation, we want to also believe that we come back to be useful and not to be rich again. That we come back to serve those who need and not become involved in a selfish, competitive way of life. Actually, man's great cycle of rebirths is great enough to bring us all to perfection. If it was not, all would fail. But that power which sees each sparrow's fall is not unmindful of the struggle through which life passes, and recognizes that this struggle is unnecessary. And so the prophets, they say, have come to tell us the truth. the sages and the saints and the seers have revealed to us the workings of the law. They are the highest authority we know, the highest because in our own hearts we realize that what they said was the thing most close to truth that we have ever heard. So these wisdoms are available to all of us, and they can begin the quiet process of helping us to orient ourselves in our own life stream. We are flowing through time and eternity. We are like ships that pass in the night. We have all the contacts and relationships of existence, and for the most part, we resent them. But if we did not resent them, if we understood them, we would find that this great pattern of life is far more beautiful, far more wonderful than we have ever expected it to be. If we go out into the hillsides and into the valleys and we see flowers growing at the roots of ancient trees, we see beauty everywhere. We see everywhere things fulfilling themselves. We see the marvelous growth of life. We see that each thing is constantly releasing life from within itself. Man, having a more advanced organism than these other things, is not aware that the constant release of life through himself results in the ultimate beauty and the ultimate cooperation and the ultimate re-identification of living things with the life within them. Nature, in its wonder, has given us hundreds of different colors of flowers and the plumage of birds and the scales of fishes. It has given us tiny things so small that even the microscope can barely capture them, and faced us with vastness so great the most powerful telescope cannot penetrate it. All this vast coordination is not in constant conflict. If planets are not colliding every once in a while, the various forms of life are regulated by immutable procedures, and all these things are unfolding from within themselves according to law. And where man abuses this law, he ceases to unfold. He is no longer part of the plan. And it is very important for him to consider more deeply this plan and try to harmonize with it for his own good and his own security. We have also one other point to make in connection with this mill of the gods, and that is that most of all, it encourages us to obedience. The only answer is to who do we obey? Do we obey those who are the natural sophisticates who have led us into trouble since the beginning? Do we obey those who are seeking to exploit us? Do we obey those to whom obedience is given by fear alone? Do we obey because they have some mysterious hypnotic influence on us which we cannot resist because we do not understand it? To obey, finally, is to obey the universal plan, to stay in harmony with the will of heaven, to keep the rules which have been given to us and have been set forth in most of the great legal codes of the world. From the oldest time, there were great legal codes by which our conduct was directed. Way back in the time of Hammurabi in Babylonia, there was a rule, there were many rules, but there was one rule that had to do with a man who built a house. The rule had many interesting branches and implications in it, but the substance was this. If a man builds a house badly, and that house falls down, or does not fulfill its purpose properly, the owner, who is the sufferer, has the right to decide what shall happen to the culprit. If he says the culprit should be hanged, there's a possibility that he might be. But most likely, the owner would say, I want thy house rebuilt and rebuilt correctly. And if the builder refused to do this, he was imprisoned. There was no further death. Every transaction must be honorable. And that was the rule 3,000 years ago. That anyone caught adulterating a product misrepresenting a statement, breaking a promise, this type of thing was punishable by law, quickly, immediately, and without an elaborate defense by some professional lawyers. Either it was done right, or the blame went where it belonged. As a result, we find evidence that the buildings back in those days stayed together rather well, because it was necessary to have that kind of a rule. And it was also in this code all kinds of teachings and moral statutes. That code, as it was written 3,000 years ago, was more honorable, more final, more brief and clear than any code we have composed in the last 500 years. The code was intended simply for the purpose of rewarding the righteous and making the unrighteous do it over again. This type of thinking was very basic, and it was based upon a simple principle. This code, the Code of Hammurabi, was not created by Hammurabi. It was created by God and revealed to the great king, probably to his counselors and those who served him. But the final authority, the final power, was rested in heaven. And anyone who broke the laws of men broke the laws of God. Of course, there are laws that have come in now to protect the guilty. They weren't in the Code of Hammurabi. But in substance, those laws which are right and proper originated in revelations like the Ten Commandments, revelations of sages and prophets. They were the foundation of civilization. And before them, all human beings had to live in a condition of humility. Only the eternal is self-governing. All else must be governed. Only that which is the eternal lawmaker is the master of the universe. And this lawmaker is eternally good and eternally wise, and is the only power that we know that is fully aware of its own purposes. Under such conditions, it is said by Plato that in a republic or a democracy, the best must govern the rest. In the great universal plan of things, the best must govern the rest. And the best is the eternal principle of life itself, manifesting through an immutable pageantry of laws. These laws are the will of the Creator. These laws are the substance of the good life, and how man can live it and come in time to the fullness of his own purpose. But before this power that alone knows, all are servants together. All are in bondage to truth, which is a happy state, whereas bondage to error is the most miserable condition that is imaginable. But bondage to truth is to be always termed in the form that the burden is light and the yoke is light. Truth, in serving it, we find not a hard taskmaster, but something that becomes more and more adorable to us, until in the service of truth, or in the service of each other, or in the service of the divine plan, we come to peace, happiness, and security. All these principles are involved in the realization that the laws of nature work. That the laws of nature, as Aesop said, have as their principal vocation the raising up of the lowly and the casting down of the great. Everywhere in nature there is a divine justice. And while generation after generation may pass and not be aware of this justice and believing that they can live in contrary to it, will perpetuate their own selfish and self-centered policies. The final fact remains that there is no mistake that we ever made that we do not have to correct. There is no example of ignorance which must not be transmuted into wisdom. There is no hate that must not be transformed into love. Everything that is negative and dangerous to us arises from our own ignorance and is scattered abroad by the various means of communication that we have today. All that is not true shall be ground down. All that is true shall be lifted up. All that has to do with the future of the world will be worked with. Nature will step in. Strategy and crime and suspicion and all these things will be washed out. They will be finally cleansed by the plan itself. But it may be a long road. It's not something that's going to happen in a moment. But how long it takes depends very largely upon man. Because on this planet, the problems that man suffers from are man-made, and the corrections must likewise be made by man. That which he has done, he must undo. That which he has falsely built up, he must recognize his mistakes and correct his attitudes. Policies that are not good for all are not good for anyone. And all the struggle for power, the struggle to conquer, all this is a delusion. For we are always, and have been always, fighting war after war for possession of this little molehill we call the earth. And when we get it, what do we have? Simply a graveyard. So nature is trying to tell us these things. Nature is trying to make it obvious to us that nature will win. That no power that man can use can corrupt the law upon which existence stands. The individual who says he is breaking a law really telling us that the law is breaking him. Man can never break any laws except those he made himself. And even some of these perhaps should be broken, others should not. But no man can break the divine law. No one can interfere with the immutable purposes of the infinite plan. These purposes will be fulfilled, and in the fulfillment of them will bring us all in due time to a condition of actual security that cannot be destroyed by political motions. The utopia we hope for can never be conquered or captured by an ambitious despotism. The thing that we are looking for is a world which will cease to realize or believe that in the conquest of others there is greatness. Greatness lies in the conquest of self. And this is something we all have to learn. And when we learn it, we will realize what the mills of the gods are doing. The mills of the gods are making this final achievement of integrities inevitable. They are going to grind away the false values. They are going to grind away that which is destructive. And they probably will grind swords into plowshares one of these days, we hope. But always the plan works. And a great faith in this is the greatest strength that man has today to combat the pressures of the world in which he lives. If we are quiet and firm and true within ourselves, we are one with reality. And it is better to be one with reality in a very simple way than to be the ruler of all the nations of the earth. Because no one can really be their ruler. The ruler was there before they came. The ruler has always been there and always will be there. But sometime we will have the wit to realize this, and in so doing start the kind of world we all hope for. Well, time's up, folks. We'll just that's it.